Joshua chapter 14, verses 1 to 5. Start us off. These are the areas which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel distributed as an inheritance to them. Their inheritance was by lot, as the Lord had commanded, by the hand of Moses, for the nine tribes and the half-tribe. For Moses had given the inheritance of the two tribes and the half-tribe on the other side of the Jordan. But to the Levites he had given no inheritance among them. For the children of Joseph were two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and they gave no part to the Levites in the land, except cities to dwell in, with their common lands, for their livestock, and for their property. As the Lord had commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did, and they divided the land. So we've looked at that before, but just to give you a little bit more as to what that would actually look like to these Levites, they were provided cities to live in all of these tribes. That was to be what the tribes gave to them. And that was a part of their giving to God, was to give the Levites cities, give them lands, and all of their other things that go with it. And there were other things. There was the produce from the land. There was 48 cities also were assigned to them, 13 of which were for the priest to dwell in, which included their families. And Devin, please add to this any knowledge you have from being in Israel. Along with their dwellings, they had suburbs in which they could keep their herds, flocks, fields, and vineyards, which they had received from the people. That would be the tithe that they were giving, and it would help out with the priest. Numbers 35, verses 2 to 5, will give you details on that. 9 of these cities were in Judah, 3 in Naphtali, and 4 in each of the other tribes. That's from Joshua 21. 6 of the Levitical cities were set apart as cities of refuge. And he was safe there until that high priest died, and then he could return. So, cities of refuge. Thus the Levites were scattered among the tribes to keep alive among them the knowledge and service of God. That's what it was for, to keep alive among them the knowledge and the service of God. See how practical that is? That is so practical. If you have a chance to share Christ with somebody and they have any kind of a need at all, make sure you avail yourself to be with them, walk through them, show them how, whatever, because it's so practical. And when it's practical, it has a much better chance of becoming their life as well, if they see it lived out in a helpful manner. So, just a little bit of history to church. Maybe you don't know how church works. So 50 years ago, ministers didn't own their own home or land on which it stood. These belonged to the church, and they worked in it. Maria and I began our ministry in Alberta in 1999. The church provided the homes that we lived in. We lived in their mats, and that was part of how they supported us. We moved to Duncan, and you provide us with the means to purchase a home. So we've done that. This comes to us as part of our salary. It provides us with retirement option and the choice of what color we'd like to paint our home, which was actually something that bothered Maria when we were in Alberta. We'd have to check with the board, and it'd have to be voted on and all the rest of it. And now we just fight among ourselves. So it's anyway, Joshua 14, verses 6 to 15. Actually, if you can paint a house together, you can put wallpaper together. You may have been squabbling a bit, but you were able to work it through. Then the children of Judah came to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know the word which the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea." Now, do you have that? Did you get that, Devin? Do you have that? You can put that up there anytime, actually. You have a map of it? Okay. "Concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me to Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought back word to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. So Moses swore on that day, saying, 'Surely the land where your foot has trodden shall be your inheritance, and your children forever, and your children's forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God. And now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, ever since the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel wandered in the wilderness, And now, here I am, this day, 85 years old. As yet, I am as strong this day as on the day when Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so now it is my strength for war, both for going out and for coming in. So he'd not just go to war, he'd make sure he got back. Now, therefore, give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke in that day. For you heard in that day how the Anakim were there, and that the cities were great and fortified. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. And Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as an inheritance. Hebron, therefore, became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. And the name of Hebron formerly was Kirjath Arba. Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Then the land had rest from war. Right in there, mountainous area. Was not the best piece of land. But Caleb was faithful to God, and he knew there were some giants left. And he knew he could do it because God was with him. And so he did it. He didn't settle for himself. He wouldn't settle until he had God's will. It's a good way to be. But Caleb had a promissory note that he would succeed. This was his promissory note. God's will. And that's what kept him going. And he would stick his neck out in the midst of God's will, and he'd be fine. If you know it's God's will, stick your neck out. If you're not sure, find out. And don't rest until you do, because that's your success. That's your life, no matter where it leads you, no matter what it costs you. That's what we have to settle in, not settling for something else. It was God's desire to clean out the land and give it to the children of Israel. Caleb was simply receiving a gift that he knew God was giving. Yes, Caleb had amazing faith, but he had an even more amazing God. Make your focus God, not your faith. Have faith. Absolutely. Have faith. But don't make your focus your faith. Make God your focus. And you will have faith. And what little bit you have, he will stretch it till it just about breaks. But when the thing is over that you're in, your faith will be even stronger. Caleb was 40 years old when he spied out the promised land. He's now 85 years. So their fighting in the promised land had gone on for 45 years. In chapter 15, Caleb succeeds in driving the giants out of the land. They were in the area called Hebron, Joshua 15, verses 13 and 14. Now to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, he gave a share among the children of Judah, according to the commandment of the Lord to Joshua, namely Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron. Arba, as I said, was the father of Anak. Caleb drove out the three sons of Anak from there, Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmai, the children of Anak. The Anakim that Caleb speaks of in Joshua 14:12 are the sons of Anak, found listed here. Joshua 15, verses 16 and 17. I expect that you're reading through these chapters, if you've come here all the time, as we're going through Joshua, and are a bit familiar as we go along. No need to labor in verse by verse. You can do that on your own. And Caleb said, "He who attacks Kirjath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give Aksa, my daughter, as wife." So Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, took it, and he gave him Aksa, his daughter, as wife. Othniel, Caleb's brother, became the first judge of Israel after Joshua's death. He was the next one in line. This was a difficult time for Israel as they began to compromise what God had told them to do in regards to getting rid of the people who inhabited their promised land. And this is how their compromise went. This was the cycle, and it repeated itself over and over and over. They compromised and fashioned the will of God to suit themselves. Oh, I can't see myself doing that, really. What are you doing looking at yourself? Seriously. Don't look at yourself when you think about the will of God. Look at God. He'll show you what he's able to do in, through, and in spite of you. So they compromise, fashion the will of God to suit themselves. Altering the will of God slightly to suit one's fancy leaves one in direct opposition to God. You don't have to turn 180. You just have to tweak it a bit. And you find yourself in opposition to God. And that's why life doesn't work. Life may be tough with God. I'm not saying it's going to be breezy and easy. There'll be persecution and the enemy will be after you and all that stuff. But you'll always be the head and not the tail. He'll always see you through it. So after that, God sent an enemy to raid them. Usually the people that they should have driven out of the land. Well, wouldn't you know? I should have dealt with that. I didn't. And now it's tripping me up. Bingo. How it works. We've been set free, but we don't live in that freedom. We go back to the world. We start living in compromise. Don't expect it to work. Because that compromise will come back and make your life unbearable. So at this point, they cried out to God. That's the beginning of revival. They cried out to God. They stopped trying to fix the mess they made. The mess got so bad they couldn't fix it. They cried out to God. Those times when you can't go any further are a great time. I love that saying on the wall. When life drives you, knocks you on your knees, you're in the perfect place to begin to pray. So that's what happened. So God sent a judge to lead them in battle. Perfect. Do it for them. No, that wasn't the lesson. Do it with them so they'd learn how to do it. What's that thing about missionaries? If you give them a fish, you feed them for a day. If you teach them how to fish, you feed them for a lifetime. That's God working with us and in us. And through us. Yes, He is our strength. And He causes us to know that we depend upon Him. But when it comes to the person side of that kind of scenario, like I am here not to do things for you, to do things with you. So that we can walk together and have more faith together in God. So God sent a judge, lead them in battle, showing them that driving out the enemy cannot happen apart from trusting God. That was the lesson. Driving out the enemy cannot happen apart from trusting God. And that's where the compromise comes in. It was too difficult, so I compromised. I couldn't see myself doing that. Again, what are you doing looking at yourself? After the battle, there was a time of peace. And the people began to compromise again. So not just in difficult times do we compromise, but a time of peace. And we begin to compromise again. I've said it over and over. Our most dangerous point is when we have succeeded. When we've got to where we wanted to be, or something happened that we wanted to happen, watch out. The enemy attacks right there because we're not on guard. Compromise is a sure-to-fail method we will be engaged in if the purpose is to make God's will fit into our lives. This is what Jesus was getting at when he said, nobody tries to put new wine into old wineskins, from Matthew 9, verse 17. He's pressing upon them the thought that if you have enough sense to not put new wine into old wineskins, then surely you have the same sense to not try and put new life into an old lifestyle. It does not work. It's like putting a brand new beefed up engine in the same old car with the same old transmission and the same old small differential. First time you put your foot into it, you're going to leave those transmission and the differential on the road. It can't be trusted. And trying to put a new life into an old lifestyle is not going to work. Thank God. It won't work. Old wineskins are not able to flex. But new wine must have room to become all that it is and all that it will be in that vessel. That's God in our life. Hence, we put it in a new container. One that has not been stretched beyond its original form yet. And God will do that. Your life will become so much more than it could ever be before. ever was before, but it has to happen on His terms, not yours. This is not a self-improvement program. God is not here to help you get better. He is your life. Yes, stretch beyond original form, not here to make us better, here to cause us to get over ourselves, to know that He is our life. Not try to polish up something that we think He'd be impressed with. He is our life. And why? Because we, as it says in the book of Ephesians from the New Testament, are dead without Christ. We're dead in our trespasses and sins. Well, dead people can't do anything. And they look ridiculous if they try. We need His life. He is our life. We need to be locked into that. Churches can become old wineskins. They reach a certain size or measure in their surrounding community. Most everyone is satisfied, and so staying where they are, the way they are, becomes a greater priority than being stretched beyond its current identity. It can happen in a church. Why is it that we believers are quick to accept Jesus as our substitutionary death, that is His death on the cross, and yet we are not always willing to accept Him as our substitutionary life? Yeah, we got the death part. Why not the life part? Oh, well, I always try to do my best for Jesus. Yeah, and it wasn't enough. A lot of people spend a lot of time trying to get Jesus to fix their past instead of celebrating Him as their future. That's another thing that'll drag us down. This can manifest itself in the great amount of energy often spent trying to make Jesus prominent in their life. And this is always done instead of living in the restfulness of His preeminence. When He's first in your life, you can rest in that. But if He isn't, you won't. There won't be rest. The hauntings of you trying to deal with the old life and make it submit to God are going to drive you crazy. And you will not have that kind of rest, that kind of strength, because you're trying to fix the wrong life. You don't need to fix it. You just walk away from the old life and walk into the new one. Live by the new life, not by the old one. This method, if you will, at attaining a life of holiness, like all this energy in trying to make Jesus prominent in your life, this method of attaining holiness always fails. Guaranteed. Always fails. There have been pastors that have burned out because they missed this. They were too busy building the church, not realizing that Jesus builds the church. Too busy trying to fix people's lives, not realizing that Jesus is the great healer. And they miss it. And they burn out and they get a restart. And what's the restart? Oh, preeminence. Christ, not me. Christ, not me. Mankind, ever since the fall, has had a tendency to trust in itself before trusting in God. The nation Israel was no exception. At this point in their history, we witness once again, as we witness them following Moses, to trust in the man God had sent instead of trusting in God who sent the man. We'll follow the preacher. We'll follow the teacher. No, that's not it. That's the wrong message. Follow God. Follow God. And that's why if you ever do any preaching, don't paint it a different color. Don't try to decorate it. Don't try to make it more acceptable. Just preach the Word. Preach Christ. They missed the message. The message was and still is. God is equally strong to deliver any life that realizes its weakness and need for deliverance. Before God ever moves out, He first moves in. Before He ever moves you out to anywhere, He needs to first move in. And we hold that door. That doorknob. There's no doorknob on that door. It's on the inside. We like to blame God when things don't get done. He needs to move. Before he'll move out, he needs to move in. Move out and clear the promised land. Clear the promised life. Be the way, the truth, and the life. He needs to first move in and do that before your life begins to move out. So if we've just got God in a pocket somewhere or in a box and He's fixing our life, that's endless. That's eternity, but it's not heaven. Instead of subjecting ourselves to the presence of God by attending meetings where God's power is moving the leaders, you know, we all like to feel that. Why not submerge ourselves in the preeminence of Christ and enjoy His strength in the midst of where we are? That's what it means to make us... This is not a good morning. That's what it means to make us the head and not the tail. You set the pace. The head is in the front of the horse. That sets the pace. The tail, that just swats flies. And it's out of the way when it needs to. It follows the head. So if God hasn't moved in, you're not moving out because you're still in charge. When He's the head, you're the head with Him. And you move out. Don't follow the crowds. Don't follow the status quo. Don't follow the peer pressure. His friend in the midst, His strength in the midst of our weakness overshadowing and overwhelming our need for control through His love, which compels and constrains. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 14 and 15. I love that. Throw the ducks away. Throw the ducks away. Throw your life away. Put it in Jesus' hands and leave it there. And then follow. You'll be able to follow then. If you don't do that, you won't be able to. You'll always be insisting that this was this way and that's that way. Okay.